Hello and welcome to episode 2.20, the June 14th, 2023, Midsummer edition of Notes from the Aisle Seat, the podcast that covers the arts in Northern Chautauqua County, sponsored by the 1891 Fredonia Opera House. My name is Tom Laughlin, and I'm your host as we bring you news and information about arts events at the Opera House and around the region, including interviews with artists and creators across the county. I have to make a confession to you all. For many years, I was under the impression that midsummer occurred in the middle of the astronomical summer season, which is mid-June to mid-September. That would put midsummer around the first week of August, which, according to the calendar, would be approximately the sixth week of the 12-week season. But I was dead wrong, as it turns out. Midsummer, according to the ancient pagan, Wiccan, and Celtic calendars, is the equivalent of the summer solstice, which by our reckoning is the astronomical first day of summer. Ancient naturalist cultures viewed the solstice as the middle of the sun's journey from its equal location at the spring equinox to its equal location at the autumnal equinox, the period of time where the sun is strongest and provides the highest amount of light and warmth. While we think of summer just beginning at the solstice, ancient cultures thought of summer as halfway through, hence midsummer, or its Celtic name, Letha. This realization changed my perspective on many things, not the least of which was the time of year of Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream, as well as my own sensations at this time of year, mixed between the celebration of all the light and warmth, and the realization that this is as good as it's going to get, and the descent into darkness has just begun. Thinking about this time of year as midsummer is a good change, too, as I think it will add a new slant to the spring months in coming years. Feeling like I'm right in the middle of summer, as opposed to summer just beginning, makes it all the more enjoyable. Some scholars have said that Letha is also a Freemason holiday, and the upcoming Live at the Met presentation of Mozart's opera Die Zauberflöte, or The Magic Flute, has been connected to the rituals of Freemasonry, both in its fantastical, magical, mythical storyline, as well as in the rituals and trials its central characters undergo. Professor Emeritus Dan Ehas joins me in a conversation to discuss some of these themes in the opera, as well as its glorious music. It's always wonderful to be able to tap into the mind of Mr. Dan Ehas, who is with me to talk about the Metropolitan Opera's Live at the Met production of The Magic Flute coming up at the 1891 Fredonia Opera House. He is retired professor of voice and on the voice faculty at SUNY Fredonia. Dan, as always, welcome.
Oh, Tom, thanks again for having me. This is one of the first operas I was ever involved in as a student, and I've seen it many times, many different kinds of productions. And in fact, I was at a recent production that was an all Fredonia cast at collaboration with the Buffalo Philharmonic, conducted by Joanne Folletta. And It had all Fredonia students and one Fredonia faculty member in it. It was produced by Julie Newell and stage directed by Paul Makovec.
Wow. And this was a concert version, yes?
Yeah. It was staged, and there's no room on the stage when the BPO orchestra is up there to have a set.
Right.
But there were costumes, and it was all staged.
Oh, costumes. I didn't even realize it had costumes. Too great.
Yeah. Yeah. It was really exciting and very colorful. I think Laurel Wolford maybe had done the costumes as well. Mm-hmm. And some of the leads of Papageno was Michael Hawk.
Oh, Michael. Michael's coming to the 1891 Fredonia Opera House in concert. He's going to give a solo concert coming up. That's great.
That's right. That's right. And John Turano, you might remember him. He's from Orchard Park originally, I think. Alumni from here, fantastic tenor. Mary Hengly was the Pamina. She was just fantastic. Our recent Pops concert, we had Jordan Pitts, who's also from Buffalo, as one of the soloists, but he played Monostatos in that production, so that was nice.
Oh,
Amanda
wow.
Bottoms was also in that production. It was wonderful. It was all Fredonia. Adam Lobke was conducting the chorus, which was made up of all Fredonia students, so on and so
Wow.
forth. It was just wonderful.
Wow. How did I not find out about this? This sounds like a terrific thing to go to.
Well, it was delayed because of COVID. It was supposed to
Ah.
happen 2 years ago, but it got delayed. And we were lucky enough to keep most of the leads in the cast because, they're all professionals now and they have agents and contracts and stuff. And so
Right.
Kyle Van Schoonhoven was to be the original Tamino for us. And he just made his Met debut in Aida, I think in April 29th or something like that. So he wasn't able to be with us. But the others were able to work around their schedule pretty much to be with us, like Michael and Mary Hengly was also a replacement, but fabulous soprano. She's been singing all over the place, and it was just a wonderful production.
Well, it's a really delightful opera, and I find that when people go to see the Magic Flute, they're always it's highly entertaining. Mozart did a fantastic job writing this, and I believe it was published and performed. He actually conducted the orchestra for the premiere, as I recall, but he died like maybe 3 or 4 months after it opened.
Yeah, it was his last opera. And I'll use the term opera a little loosely because this is unusual, unlike many other operas that have lots of recitative and then, set numbers like arias or duets or choruses of some kind. This is really called a Singspiel, which is a sung play. And the text, there's a lot of spoken dialogue in it. But what you're going to see in this production is going to it'll have a combination of those normal set pieces that we're used to hearing, arias, duets, trios, so on. And then it'll have some spoken dialogue in German and then some sung recitative as well.
Productions in the past have really relied on stage directors to do a good job with this, and there's a lot of history behind the people who've directed this show. I think at the Met, the most recent one, I think it's been 14 years since Julie Taymor put on a production that has lasted quite some time. And of course, she won Tonys for The Lion King, and as I understand it, her production of The Magic Flute had puppets and all kinds of stuff going on.
Yeah, amazing. I think that production initiated in 2004 or something like that. And I've seen clips of it. I did not see that production, but I have seen The Lion King about 4 times. And it's amazing the creativity. This has to do with all kinds of fantasy and mysticism and so on. And so having someone with that kind of creative ability really opens the opera up to everyone's individual creativity, what you see and what you understand from it. I think these new types of productions really invigorate what is a fantastic story anyway, to make it relevant today, to relevant to our younger audiences and to people who have seen, like I've seen The Magic Flute. I've been in many productions myself, and yet the clips that I saw of this were really engaging.
The stage director for this is Simon McBurney, and he is probably better known to American audiences as an actor. And if I name some of the movies that he was in, such as I believe he's been in Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part One. He was in Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. As a character actor, he has quite the reputation, but he also has an amazing reputation in England now as a stage director. And he brings an imagination to this production that's incredible.
Oh, I watched the clip that's on the Met website about this. He just seems to me to be the most creative and brilliant mind. He speaks so well, and he has a very clear vision of what he wants to do with this production. And the clips that I saw, I've never seen anything quite like this before. It's like taking Julie Taymor's production and pumping it up on steroids. It's just amazing that the Pamina and the Tamino sort of fly in on wires. It's amazing. The Queen of the Night, everyone knows the Queen of the Night, who, by the way, is supposed to be the representation of Maria Theresia, and that we'll get to that later because that there's some conflict with Freemasonry. And in any case, she's in a wheelchair, and she's got a staff. And the clip that I saw, she's really they really bring her out as a sorcerer, and she has the power to move Tamino anywhere she wants to, you know, on the stage. And he's powerless against her. It's pretty cool, and I think, you know, we oftentimes will say, you know, for someone, your first opera should be something that's sort of light, exciting, but light, not too dramatic, you know, that kind of thing. This is a great opera for kids, but with all of this fantastical stuff that they're doing with the staging, it makes it even more engaging for children and adults.
Yes, it does. I mean, this is an opera that if you do have children, it would be interesting to bring them to see what their reaction is. And when you say, you know, the woman who is singing the role of the Queen of the Night, Catherine Lewick, she has a fantastic coloratura soprano. But when you look at her as the Queen of the Night, sitting in a wheelchair, hobbling around the stage, just during her very famous revenge aria, she's just apparently just back and forth all over the place. You don't expect the Queen of the Night to look like an old sorceress, hag, witch kind of character.
Exactly. And you know, amazingly, I don't really know her voice that well, but I did listen to a couple of clips. I mean, my estimation, it's amazing. But she's had some long record of number of performances of the Queen of the Night at the Met, like
44.
44. Yeah. That's a long run, and that's really just challenging. It's like the most challenging. Everybody knows those arias because they're so popular, but it's also because it's so challenging. And she's had a great run of it so far. So that'll be very exciting to watch as well.
It's interesting that we talked about you know, the actual influence of Freemasonry on Mozart, but a lot of people see this opera, and many articles have been written about this opera and its connection to the Freemasonry movement, and particularly which was particularly popular in Mozart's day. And some people, I believe, think Mozart himself was a Freemason.
Yeah, my understanding, and from what I've seen and read, that he was part of the Freemasons. It's a secret society. No one's supposed to know that you belonged to it. No one's supposed to know what you do. Every time I asked about Freemasonry, I'd get some vague sort of answer. And I think even doing some research on it, you don't get a lot of clarity. You know, you don't find their doctrine. Like if you look up the Presbyterian Church or the Catholic Church or something like that, you're going to get, you know, here's the doctrine that they believe. But I think it's really interesting. We have a Masonic temple here in town. Every little town seems to have one. So you have to help me out here because I don't really know the exact details of what they believe.
The thing that I do know about Freemasonry, they're very hard to pin down sometimes, but two of the three different branches of it require a belief in a supreme being, a god of some sort. But they're not dogmatic in that. You know, there's no sense of dogma. You just have to have a belief in a supreme being. And from there, you know, they were very instrumental. Perhaps their biggest contribution was that they were very instrumental in the spreading of Enlightenment ideas in the 18th and 19th centuries.
Right. And so that leads me to another little thing I wanted to mention, and it's about Maria Theresia in Vienna, because she was really completely opposed to any of this Freemasonry. And I think maybe that led to a lot of the secrecy, you know, like an underground sort of group of people that were operating in with good intent, not with any sort of malintent, but you know, she was really opposed to it, and she would probably have shut this down had she known. But Mozart and Schikaneder, who was also Freemason,
The
he's the one
librettist,
who wrote this
Schikaneder, huh?
librettist, they wove the whole initiation process of Freemasonry into the story of the magic flute. And that's the trials that both Pamina and Tamino have to go through so that they can share their true love. And really, the basic line is that the universal theme is that true love will win out in the end.
Correct.
and everything will be in harmony and so on. And
Right.
that
And,
part is the
and true love represents that enlightenment, that wisdom, that so on and so forth that is involved in that. It's a rather involved story, actually, when you come down to it. It's very hard to summarize in a podcast, but it is really a journey towards true love and enlightenment and harmony ultimately within the world.
So I have a quote from an article I found online, which I thought was really good, and it sort of sums it up pretty succinctly. It says, a common Masonic theme is that music has the power to transcend human fear and hatred. So the moral of the story is that through the Masonic order and guided by the beauty of music, society can be enlightened, which I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I just want to throw in a couple of things that I remember from my music history classes years ago when I was a student. The number three or threes of some kind appear everywhere in here, whether it's in the music meter itself or in compound meter, like something could be in 6/8, but that's two divisions of three, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
But the first thing that really catches my attention is those first three big chords in the overture. Dum dum, dum dum, dum dum. You know, those three big chords. That's how it starts, right? And then it goes off from that.
Right.
But then you have the three ladies. And you have the three spirits. I mean, everything is in some sort of combination, right?
Yes.
And, you know, you've got the good forces against the evil forces, but in the end, everything sort of comes back into harmony. Anyway, I thought that was pretty cool.
It is. It really is. Well, you know, I just to really touch quickly on Nathalie Stutzman as the conductor. She is conducting her second opera. She did the Don Giovanni just a couple of weeks ago, and now she's conducting her second opera at the Met. And it's, you know, apparently it's kind of historical. Not since Sarah Caldwell has there been a female conductor. Is that right?
Yeah, you know, I looked it up and I didn't find any evidence of anybody else really having this kind of experience at the Met. But the one thing that I did notice is that I think it came right from the Met's webpage that they indicated that not since another male conductor, Raphael, somebody or another, had someone, a conductor, have in their debut season two operas. And this is a female.
Well, this production is just bursting with musical talent. You know, Erin Morley is Pamina, Catherine Luke is the Queen of the Night, Lawrence Brownlee is Tamino, Stephen Milling as Zarastro, and Papageno being played by the Dutch singer Thomas Olmans, I think, is, you know.
It's his Met debut.
Yeah, and his Met debut, exactly. And so it's also Lawrence Brownlee's Met debut, I believe. In a Mozart,
might be because I saw him in La Fille du Régiment.
Yeah,
that's the aria where the tenor sings nine high C's in a row.
Oh my god!
I lucked out and got tickets that somebody didn't want. I was in about the sixth row orchestra.
Wow,
Tom, it was electric. He is so good. He sang all those. Every one of them was perfect. The opera stopped right there. People were standing and applauding. And they've done this a couple of times where they have them sing it again because the audience won't stop applauding.
Right.
I didn't experience that, but he could have easily done that. And it happens relatively early in the opera too.
Right.
So I listened to the clips of this and Larry sounds just absolutely fantastic. By the way, he's an amazing musician, kind of jazz pianist, and he can riff with all the best gospel singers out there. He's amazing. If people are interested, look him up on YouTube because it's really kind of an amazing talent.
Yeah, wonderful, wonderful. So, you know, audiences, again, I think they'll have a magic time in the opera if they go see the Magic Flute. Dan, thank you very much for this conversation.
Absolutely.
I enjoyed myself immensely. It's going to be a very nice Live at the Met experience. And I imagine maybe I'll see you there again.
Okay, sounds good. Thanks
All right.
so much, Tom.
Thank All right. you. Bye bye. Die Zauberflöte will be screened at the 1891 Fredonia Opera House on Saturday, June 17th, beginning at 1 p.m. Tickets are $20 for adults, $18 for Opera House members, $10 for students, or you can use one of your Flex season passes. Call the Opera House box office at 716-679-1891 for tickets or more information. A special note about this performance: it is not a live screening of a live event at the Met, but rather a screening of the recorded performance of June 3rd. The rescheduling was done so as not to conflict with the Bratz and Beyond fundraiser on June 3rd. Live at the Met is underwritten with support from Daniel S. Kaufman and Timothy W. Beaver. One of my bucket list items is a trip to Japan. I have always been intrigued by Japanese culture and art, and the manner in which they apply intense focus and discipline to almost every aspect of their society. The next exhibition on screen, entitled Tokyo Stories, focuses on the development of the visual arts in Tokyo from its beginnings as the city of Edo, rising to the international prominence Tokyo has in the 21st century. I was very, very fortunate to find a visual artist who has spent almost 30 years in Japan as a Westerner, practicing and exhibiting his work in Japanese art galleries, a very rare occurrence. Adam Cooley is a native of Western New York, currently living in North Carolina, and I was fortunate to get a little of his time as he prepares to return to Japan with the lifting of COVID sanctions. He gives us a perspective of his experiences with Japanese art in this interview. Well, it's great to be joined by Mr. Adam Cooley. Adam is an artist who is currently living in North Carolina, but he spent a good portion of his time as an artist in various locations in Tokyo, Japan, and elsewhere. And it's great to have him on the program. Thanks for doing this, Adam. Much appreciated.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
You bet. Now, as you know, this isn't really so much about the documentary Tokyo Stories, because that's going to speak for itself, and neither of us have seen it yet. We've seen little clips of it and so on, but it does look like a fascinating documentary. But more so, you know, we wanted to get your perspective on the art scene in Tokyo. So we'll ask you a little bit about that, and then we'll go from there. So in the first place, of course, give us a little bit about your background as an artist, what kind of media you work with, and how you got to Japan.
Okay, so my name is Adam Cooley. I'm mostly a painter and sculptor, and I also got into performance art initially. So I ended up, it was kind of a series of fortunate accidents that kind of led me to Japan. I was supposed to go to India. I had my ticket booked and right about to fly out, and there was a cholera outbreak, and this is travel agent period. So it was like my travel agent called me and said, oh, the flight would be fine, but you won't be able to get a visa. So what do you want to do? And I was, I'm supposed to fly in 3 weeks. And I said, oh, I don't know what to do. So she said, okay, how about to go someplace else? I said, okay, where? And she said, how about Japan? And I said, yes. And 2 weeks later, I was landing in Tokyo, landing in Narita, actually. So
interesting. That's an interesting story. Yeah. So, you have spent a good amount of time, at least over 10 years or more.
30 years.
30 years. Oh, my. It's even more than I could tell from your bio. 30 years working and exhibiting in Japan. Can you give us an idea of what it is about the scene, the art scene in Japan, that kept you there all those years?
I think for me, I really like initially I liked the culture, the traditional culture. I live mostly in Osaka, but I mean, I was, my art dealer's in Tokyo. So my exhibitions are in Tokyo, Kyoto, Nara, I mean, all over the country. But I really fell in love with the underground aspect of the art scene. So I think that, I mean, the not so, at the time it was the not so famous art scene in Japan. And I just kind of fell into the flow of things. And yeah, so I've been very fortunate.
Yeah, do you think it's unusual that coming from the United States to be able to exhibit so much in Japan? Is that an unusual thing for you to do?
Yeah. I know that at least two galleries, and one of them was a 400-year-old company that has their own gallery, and I was the first living foreign artist to exhibit there. But like I had an exhibition where they paired my work off with Kusama Yayoi, the polka dot. Yeah. So,
yes.
So yeah, that was very, it just happened to, that gallery is it's a big gallery in Kyoto. It was like, it's one of the oldest businesses there. And they have they actually have a museum on the top floor. And then they have another gallery, which I was on the fifth or seventh floor. I think the museum's on the eighth floor. And that time they had Kusama Yayoi's artwork. Mm-hmm. So they wanted to have, and I was the first, at the time, I was the first foreign living artist to exhibit at that gallery. So they wanted to have this pop Japanese icon and this foreign, odd artist at the same time. So it was a very nice experience. I didn't have the chance to meet her, unfortunately. And they also had, I had an exhibition at the Red Brick Warehouse, which is no longer there, but I know that they had flown in Onoyoko's train car. I don't know if you're familiar with it. It's a train car, just a giant train car that's full of bullet holes, but they had shipped it over. And I don't know if she had, a lot of artists attend or secretly attend, or they like pop in. But I know I missed her. I think it was like a week or two between her exhibition ending and the piece I did there opening. So, but yeah, it was kind of brief, very lucky chances. So there's very few, actually. There's a lot of foreign artists in Japan, but there's very few that really exhibit regularly.
So that puts you in a quite an interesting class.
Yeah. I think and the Japanese art scene, I think if you're going, they definitely have a lot of school style or group style pattern. It's like Amway almost. So they have the highest level, like you earn your rank and move up, but you're like a deshi. So you have your teacher and you are I don't know the word in English. It's basically your apprenticing. So it's like, you're ranked down. It's the same for like tea ceremony or ikebana flower arrangement, where you have like the masters at the top and it kind of pyramids down, and you do a lot of group shows and but I never went that path.
Can you sort of give us a bit of a background when you look at Japanese art and particularly contemporary art? Because I think they're going to see a lot of that in the documentary. I think it goes from the wood blocks, the wood prints that they had, all the way up to lithography, painting, photography, the video work, that kind of thing. And it goes from very traditional to very pop art. In fact, what do you find to be the kind of the underlying perhaps artistic motifs or philosophies of Japanese art that sort of make it distinct?
Well, there's wa is like the universal, like wabi-sabi. It's the Japanese aesthetic, and I think that goes, it bridges all everything, that bridges like the new and the old, but I think they're dramatically different groups. So if you're going for woodblock printing, that's very, the structure is very hierarchical. So you have masters and students, and It's very traditional. It's a craft. So I think a lot of times Japan, when they look at art, it's from a craftsmanship perspective. So when you get into like modern stuff, especially a lot of the stuff that's popular in the West, might not be as popular in Japan, even though they're Japanese artists.
Mm.
Because a lot of times the originality, to be original and unique, isn't necessarily a good thing. Yeah, you have a few breakaway. I mean, I know, like, as I mentioned, like Kusama Yayoi has always done her own thing, and she just like skyrocketed with her work. Yeah, but I think even with her work, there's still that wow, that Japanese theme that I don't know. That's something that, and I also think the colors that you find in Japanese art don't necessarily translate to Western tastes a lot of times. I mean, and it's an unfortunate thing. I think it's like a acquired taste. Like people can come here and eat California roll. It's not really sushi. I want to say no, it's not really it. I think the same with Japanese art. I think, I mean, unless you're looking at very traditional things, like, yeah, I think there's a gap at times. Now, I mean, like calligraphy is, even for me, I was lived in Japan for 30 years. Calligraphy is a very abstract concept, and it's very hard to appreciate it unless you know the, like, even for Japanese people, it's fundamentally difficult. So it's kind of a bit of a difference, but yeah.
Do you ever get any sense when you're in Tokyo? Because Tokyo is a very modern city, and I know one of the things that seems to be true about Tokyo, from what I can tell from a distance, obviously, is that they embrace novelty. They like new things. They like to see flashy technology. They like to see different ways in which they can present old ideas. Do you find that to be true in the art world, or is that just something that I'm dreaming up?
No. I think that is. It's there's almost like two separate worlds that kind of exist within each other. So you have the traditional, it's like in Japan right now, realism, like Renaissance style realism is extremely popular, which you wouldn't really consider like a very contemporary, like America is very pop, very digital right now. But at the same time, Japan has, you have like Harajuku in Tokyo, these high fashion. Yeah, they also say there's a word in Japanese, like miha. Miha is someone who follows recent trends a little bit mindlessly. Like it's just something new. It's something new and they want to try it. But I think that's also Japanese culture. So I don't necessarily think it's only Tokyo. So like if there's a new restaurant that opens up that makes a certain kind of rolled cake, for example, if it becomes popular, it becomes immensely popular. And you'll have people waiting for 2 or 3 hours. It was the same like when Krispy Kreme opened in Japan. People would wait for 5 hours in line to get a few donuts, and you're limited to a few donuts. But I think that also means that you're a flash in the pan a lot of times. I think it's hard for, if you become a pop sensation, it's like Icarus. You burn up very quickly. Uh-huh. You become old news really quickly. So I think that's a bit of a difference. I think that's where the craftsman style ideology persists, because then you maintain forever because you're practicing artwork and themes and skills that have been passed down for hundreds of years, or thousands, depending on what you're studying.
Yes, you know, one of the things that has always fascinated me about Japanese culture is that they can take the most, what you would consider to be the most ordinary things, and turn them into a highly disciplined field. Everything from stone gardening to bonsai trees to even baseball games. I'm a big baseball fan, and one of my things on my bucket list is simply to go to a baseball game in Japan, because the way that they actually observe and watch and cheer and deal with baseball is so highly disciplined and so different. And I assume that you find a little of that then in the art world at the same time.
Yes. Yeah. And I think I would recommend Hanshin Tigers baseball game is by far the most elaborate and ritualized. It, you definitely needed a lot of endurance to go to the game. Everything is, it's amazing though. It's kind of like a cult experience, but it's definitely worth it. Yeah, I think that's another reason why I always gravitated more towards the underground art scene there. I don't know if you know Dumb Type.
No, I do not.
So there's Dumb Type, which was a group that I think it started in Kyoto. Also in Kyoto was, he was one of the first performance artists. It was Jun Kwak Duk, who was he's a Korean national who's lived his entire life in Japan. He's quite famous. And there's Buto. I don't know if you know. It's the performance art where they paint their...
I am familiar with Buto, yes.
Okay. Yeah, so I used to do that.
Ah.
That's kind of how I branched off into... I was in a documentary that was on PBS and BBC called... in a book. It was Japan Land, A Year in Search of Bois by Karen Muller.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so that was a... Yeah, so I think going that route, there's a whole world of very... Like, it's the same with anime. I think anime recently has become huge in America. But, I mean, for decades, it was this kind of underground art form. And now I see it's, like, permeated the art world. I mean, everywhere, basically. But, yeah, it's kind of interesting art.
So if you were to give, like, I don't know, one piece of insight to a Westerner who's going to see this film about the Tokyo art scene, it's going to take in like 400 years of art from Edo all the way up to modern Japan. Is there one particular lens or one particular way, mindset of going in that you might think be worthwhile?
Learning about the history. And even the contemporary history, I mean, within the last 100 years, I think will give you a very interesting, let's say 200 years. But because, I mean, if you have like the Meiji Restoration period where they're like developing their culture and pulling things from China and other parts of Asia and just kind of like reinventing themselves. I think Tokyo is a place of reinvention. Tokyo is a little bit like New York City, where you have people that are actually from New York, and then you have a lot of transplants. Mm-hmm. And Tokyo, I think, is probably 80% transplants. So usually those are the most obnoxious people because they want to say they're from Tokyo and they're not from Tokyo. It's another thing about Tokyo is people adapt to speak Tokyo dialect. So if you come from Osaka or Kyoto, when you go to Tokyo, you speak Tokyo dialect, usually. But it doesn't go the other way around. And I think it's the same way with art. I mean, Tokyo is like Hollywood and New York City combined. So if you want to become famous, if you want to pursue a grandiose life, you test your luck in Tokyo.
Well, that sounds like a fascinating way to look at the city. Wonderful. Listen, Adam, I really want to thank you for your time. It's really been kind of eye-opening to listen to you talk and get your perspective on Tokyo and the art scene there because, you know, you're a one of a kind as far as I can tell right now. So I do thank you for taking your time to talk to us.
Okay. Have a nice day.
And good luck with your next exhibition there.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Tokyo Stories will be screened at the 1891 Fredonia Opera House on Saturday, June 24th, beginning at 1 p.m. Tickets are $15 for adults, $10 for students, or you can use one of your FlexPass subscriptions, and are available online or at the box office at 716-679-1891. Here is the arts calendar for the upcoming 2 weeks. Speaking of things Japanese, the Fredonia Academy Week, sponsored by the SUNY Fredonia School of Music, will kick off its Festival Music of Japan Week, beginning on Monday, June 19th, and continuing for the next 5 days. You can get all the information on the events associated with Festival Music of Japan by going to the university website at www.fredonia.edu and following links for the School of Music. The summer season at Main Street Studios will begin on Thursday, June 29th, when a four-performance run of the popular Frank Lesser musical Guys and Dolls will open. Performances are Thursday through Saturday, June 29th through July 1st at 7:30 p.m., with a Saturday matinee at 2 p.m. You can find out more about upcoming summer events at Main Street Studios by going to their website at mainstreetstudios.org/events. And finally, the 1891 Fredonia Opera House has a special announcement about an exciting event coming in the fall. On Friday, September 22nd, 2023, at 7:30 p.m., Broadway veteran Eden Espinoza will be performing in concert at the Opera House. Ms. Espinoza is most recognized for her critically acclaimed portrayal of Elphaba in Wicked on Broadway and in Los Angeles and San Francisco. Other Broadway credits include originating the title character in Brooklyn the Musical, Flora in Flora the Red Menace, and Maureen in The Closing Company of Rent. Her television appearances include shows such as Law and Order, Ugly Betty, and Elementary. Espinosa's debut album, Look Around, charted in the pop iTunes Top 50 between Adele and Katy Perry. Her second album, Revelation, was released in 2019. This is sure to be an exciting event at the Opera House, so be sure to watch out for more information about tickets in the upcoming weeks. You can read her complete bio in the Opera House's weekly email newsletter. And remember, if you have an arts event coming up and would like to get it mentioned on the arts calendar, please send us an email to opera@fredopera.org or call the box office at 716-679-1891 with your information.
Stars, welcome to this grand illusion. All of it's yours, right through these doors.
The cinema series continues in June with screenings of two comedies, Somewhere in Queens and Book Club, The Next Chapter. And there's no one more qualified or interesting to talk to about movies than Fredonia graduate and Hollywood man about town, Paul Preston, the movie guy. Ladies and gentlemen, the movie guy is here to talk about the next couple of movies coming up in the cinema series. And every time the movie guy shows up, you know you are going to have a good time listening to him. And is because his wide expanse of knowledge in the movies is incredible. So here he is, the movie guy, Paul Preston. Paul, welcome.
Yes, and who doesn't love movies? Come on, you do. Regardless, even if it's summertime and you're like, these movies are all dumb. They're not all dumb. So
no, that's right.
Get out there and see something.
That's right. Well, you know, actually, unfortunately, I probably won't have time to talk about that. But there are a couple of movies out there I think I might want to see.
Oh, like blockbusters?
Yeah, like I might want to see Indiana Jones. I might want to see that last one, right?
Well, tell you what, I've got a little scoop. As a guy who lives in L.A., I happen to be friends with the right person who got me into an advanced screening. And if you know my history with indie since Raiders of the Lost Ark and 15 years waiting for this new movie. I will keep it brief because it's not coming to the Fredonia Opera House in the near future, but maybe in the, you know, who knows when. But I will say after the mixed bag of reviews it got coming out of the Cannes Film Festival, raise your expectations. It's fun. It's a good, solid final outing for the legendary hero.
That's awesome. All right. That's all. That's good enough for me. But let's talk about what's coming up at the Opera House. We got a couple of movies here. We'll start with Somewhere in Queens, which stars Ray Romano, who's quite a favorite actor and comedian for most people.
Well, you know, the Opera House always bringing the counter programming to the summer stuff, and rightfully so, and thankfully so too, because these, you know, chowder headed summer movies, you know, they're not all Indiana Jones. There's Fast and Furious out there. There's, you know, Super Mario, but there's dumb stuff that we need to get our, you know, adult fix to counter. Mm-hmm. And Ray Romano, this is his directorial debut, and it's decidedly adult. It's a comedy drama, not profane and full of nudity and all that, but just compared to sitcoms that he's known for, the movie delves into more complicated relationships. And I think we've talked about how great it is when relationships are complicated on this very show before, because you always bring the sort of, you know, intelligent movies that play at the opera house. Mm. And these characters make very difficult decisions in Somewhere to Queens, and that's where they find the comedy. So even though it sounds like a drama, everything I'm describing, this is a comedy. And it's about Romano and Laurie Metcalf. They play Leo and Angela Russo, who have a very shy son, but suddenly he comes alive on the basketball court. And seeing a future for his son in a family that could just be like going right into the family business, you know, just like Leo did, you know, Leo thinks, what can I do to help my son achieve a different future? And he goes to shocking lengths that I will spare you because that would be a spoiler. But again, I'm really glad your show leans me towards these movies because I may not have seen it otherwise. It's not as bad. There's way too much TV. Mm-hmm. Like people tell me, hey, you haven't seen Blank Show. Do you know how much TV there is?
There's a ton of TV. I can't keep track of it.
Can't. There's not a ton of movies, but there's still enough where something like this might have slipped by. So I'm glad the Fredoni Opera House is going to bring it so you can check it out without letting it get just out of your way of seeing it in a big screen. Because the laughs come in as a group, you know, that's always much more satisfying than just sitting at home. Now, I already mentioned Laurie Metcalf, so you know it's going to be good. She's awesome and is awesome again here. Her comedic chops are on point and her humanity is always a welcome addition to her characters that could otherwise be one-dimensional. I think she brings that a lot of the time. You know, in the wake of her son's desire and could possibly go to college, you know, she's got great one-liners, but she also has real pain, anger, and fear of him leaving at play too. So all those things get played in a nice mix. Romano plays Leo like a beaten man. He is physically sort of almost crumpled over. You know, when he walks, it kind of is like a shuffle that, you know, he's struggling through the weight of his what's on his shoulders as opposed to confidently strutting through life. You know, if you've seen him in his dramatic roles since Everybody Loves Raymond, like The Big Sick or The Irishman, he's really good. And so I like when he takes these bigger swings after that sitcom.
I very much was impressed in the trailer to see how old he lets himself look as compared to, you know, his sitcoms.
Well, his show following Everybody Who Loves Raymond, I think, was Men of a Certain Age, which I think was 50. Mm-hmm. That's got to be 10 years ago now. More, maybe not that, but still. So, yeah, he's late 50s and he's going to look good. And, you know, the story calls for it. And I like that he just brings what he has to bring for it. But again, this is a comedy. So it works mostly because of the characters and they make mistakes and keep the stakes I've mentioned real. I say the same thing about action movies all the time. Speaking of Indiana Jones, you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark. That movie has real stakes. And once you establish them with the CIA guys at the top, we can have fun. So the stakes of this are real, but they can have fun within that as opposed to like the comedy rendering the whole thing hollow, you know? So if there are real consequences, real sense of danger, then you can have all the fun you want. But I think both those things have to live in harmony to make for a great movie. And boy, they make some choices. Out is severe, but the characters are so well defined and the comedic barbs and one-liners they land with more effect, I think, because of that. And Romano wrote the script, so you know he's directing the way he wants it to go. And I think the co-writer was the guy who made Men of a Certain Age with him. So if you ever saw that, this is, you know, in a similar vein of drama and comedy. And you know, even the conclusions are very satisfying, even though they may not be for the characters. So,
okay.
As the viewer, you'll be pleased. Thanks to the Opera House, you have a chance to see this in the theater, and I recommend you do.
I did notice in the trailer there was one scene in the trailer which is it's clearly an Italian family in Queens, and they're sitting at a dinner and everybody's there, all the boys are there and blah blah blah, and I guess the girlfriend asked for meatballs because there are none on the table, and mom gets up to get the meatballs and she says, I'm going to make some more, and all the guys go, oh no, let her go, we're going to have meatballs yeah. You know, it's really funny because my wife is Sicilian, she's Italian, and man, I related to that scene so quickly, you have no idea.
Yeah, you know, dinner's going to start around 4 and around 9:30.
Yes. Oh, yes. Yes. If I had the time, I'd tell you this story, but I don't have the time.
Yeah. No, they're very overbearing. You know, there's a lot of, like, I'll tell you a personal story. the you know, my wife Karen passed away a few years ago. I developed a scholarship in her name, and the girl who was the first recipient of that scholarship just graduated Fredonia.
Wow.
And now has a stage managing job at Legoland in Florida. So anyone who ever submitted you know, funds to that, good on you. You did it. You got the nudge. She got the nudge she needed to pursue her dreams.
Great.
You know, and so this family is the kind that will just say, no, you don't need to dream. Don't buy. Well, listen, don't risk whatever you do. You know, so this is the same kind of family that could be overbearing if you're not careful. I mean, you talk about the meatballs. They end up in the same like banquet hall five times in the movie. Someone's having a baptism or a wedding or anniversary. It's just routine, routine, routine. And, you know, Romano's character sees something more for his kid. And again, that launches the whole film. So, yeah, I'm glad you found it familiar. A lot of people will, I think.
That's what I think, too. I mean, the minute I saw that scene, I said, I think people are going to like this movie just because they'll catch the familiar, the family situations, and it'll seem quite familiar to them, you know.
Yeah.
Nothing spectacular about the film, per se, in terms of its setting, you know. The spectacularness comes in terms of the characters. And I love character-driven movies. Love them. Well, let's move from somewhere in Queens, which of course takes place in Queens, New York, or rather, you know, middle class type of neighborhood, to a movie that gives us exotic venues, and that is The Book Club, The Next Chapter, and it has four fabulous women in it who have Hollywood careers. Again, if you think you know, somebody's that big in terms of their playbill, these women are just, you know, you can't put their credits on the screen. You'd be there for 20 minutes. So give us the lowdown on The Book Club.
Yeah, you got three Oscar winners and a nominee, right? Fonda for Coming Home, Jane Fonda, and Candace Bergen nominated for Starting Over. Mary Steenburgen won the Oscar for Melvin and Howard, and then Diane Keaton, of course, for Annie Hall. So it's a packed roster of female talent. I watched the first Book Club to prepare to watch the second one here, Tom, because I hadn't seen it. And but it seemed I'm in a minority there. This first movie made about $104 million at the box office, which for a small comedy, you know, about women who read 50 Shades of Grey and their lives change. That's what the first movie is pretty much all about. Their sex lives, mostly for old ladies. You know, Viagra jokes, awkward sex talk, seniors, dating online, all the jokes you know, ensued there. Mm-hmm. But they're all back now for a Book Club, The Next Chapter, and it dispenses really kind of with the book club angle, except for occasional references to what they're reading when it parallels their real life adventures. Other than that, the sequel kind of really dives into the characters and their relationships, kind of where they are now, and what are the new stakes with this trip to Italy and why they're taking it. One of them gets engaged in her 70s. So they go to have a bachelorette party of old ladies. Now, but this is the main thing to point out here. The tomato meter, if you believe it all in Rotten Tomatoes, which, you know, collates a bunch of reviews from across the country and gives it a percentage of yay or nay reviews. And so if dead vegetables are your way to warrant the quality of a movie, first of all, you might want to rethink that. But secondly, the tomato meter gives us a 47%. So that's less than half. But the audience gives it 87%.
Wow.
Not just that discrepancy happens all the time, by the way. But this one is specifically needs pointing out, because when it comes to the critics, every critic is going to critique this movie. When it comes to people, only people who want to see this will see it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So if you put only the people who wanted to see this, who were critics, reviewing it, I wonder what the percentage would be. You know, so like when you have everybody reviewing this movie, it doesn't matter, because this is meant for a certain group of people and a specialized audience base, the kind that loves Grace and Frankie, the kind that loves 80 for Brady and Palms and the entire Nancy Myers catalog, from Something's Gotta Give to It's Complicated and all her romantic comedies as well for older adults. So, you know, you probably heard this phrase with a million different movies, but if you liked Book Club, you'll like Book Club, The Next Chapter. There's simply no doubt about it, because it offers up the same stuff, really makes no huge risks, and it's not charged to in any way. You know, the theme, tone, comfort zone, all of the original are there, and it continues that counter-programming theme to, you know, dopey stuff like Fast X. There's a funny opening to the film, one of the first films, I think, that, you know, has dealt with COVID and the lockdown. The ladies are on Zoom trying to continue their book club. They're taking up hobbies and struggling with the technology, and there's lots of jokes there. But I like the film best when the characters were vulnerable. I mean, that's all over Somewhere in Queens. You know, the characters are really fleshed out and vulnerability is in high check. But here it comes every once in a while. I think the seeding, the vulnerable scenes with the jokes would have worked better than going full hog on broad comedy, slowing down for vulnerability, then going back to comedy again. It kind of creates a mixed bag where you might like some of it, might not like some of it. But again, these are sitcom-sized situations and laughs. So like the first movie, Ray Romano used this film to sort of transcend his sitcom reputation. And I think that happens more on something like Grace and Frankie, which is a TV show, if you don't know, that Jane Fonda was in with Lily Tomlin. But it doesn't happen as much here. But there are enough good-natured laughs here to please the base audience. Again, I would be a fool to sit here and go, hey, you know, 20-year-old kid, when you're done with football practice, go see the book on the next chapter. That's what these critics might be saying, like giving it a bad review, like, don't bother. Well, yeah, don't bother. Don't bother. So, right. Yeah, you know, you're not going to be won over. It's not going to suddenly, it's not the movie that's going to cross over to you. So for the audience, you know, this is another winner. And that being said, Candace Bergen gets all the good lines and delivers them the best. Diane Keaton comes across the most natural, but that sort of genial smile and charm are what she's been working for 40 years. It's all on display, you know. And look, who are we kidding? Jane Fonda is 85. I don't know why I'm whispering, Tom. Jane Fonda is 85. Bergen and Keaton are 77. Steenburgen just turned 70. Jane Fonda is 85. Okay, so if you want to see the legends in action, I do it now.
Well, yes. I mean, actually, thinking of Jane Fonda as 85 is a bit shocking for me. I didn't know she was quite that old. Wow.
And we all laughed when she did her workout tapes.
Yeah.
We should have joined in because, she's looking great. And they bring the whole gang back. You had Andy Garcia, Don Johnson, and Craig T. Nelson in supporting roles as the men in their lives.
And I got to imagine that the cinematography and the locations are fabulous.
Well, that's the other thing I was going to say. If you get the chance to see this stuff on the big screen, I mean, I went to Italy 11 years ago and there's all the familiar, the Trevi Fountain. Oh, there's the Pantheon, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And then they go to Venice, they go to Tuscany, they're all over the place. So yeah, those pictures are going to play majestically on the big screen.
So Paul, before we go, we get a quick recommendation from you. It's the summer blockbuster season, and I know you probably know what's coming up. So, you know, give us a thumbnail sketch just quickly. If we go to the movies in the regular movie theaters, what are you looking at?
Well, I already recommended Indiana Jones, but this Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, if this doesn't win Best Animated Film, it is going to win Most Animated Film. This movie is insane. Like the first one before it that won the Academy Award for Animated Film, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. And they've set themselves up for a third. So this is going to be an animated Spider-Man trilogy that really takes advantage of the fact that it's animated. Like, what can we do that we couldn't do in this live action Spider-Man movies? And they go all out. You know, the things they do, I mean, the visuals are stunning. And it's a joke feast. It's a everything. And then there's real drama and there's good acting from like animated characters, you know, as well as they really deal with, you know, the multiverse is a huge thing now between Everything Everywhere All at Once. Of course, Marvel live action is going into the multiverse. And I'm kind of impressed the way they continue to come up with interesting stories to tell about this. This multiverse continues to yield fascinating stories and a great cliffhanger at the end of this one, setting you up for the third film.
Excellent.
So I highly recommend.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll be picking that up then. Paul, as always, wonderful to talk to you. Thank you for being on the podcast. And I know probably when we have another shot to do a cinema series conversation, we will take it. So good luck to you. Have a great summer out there in LA and say hi to anybody I know.
Thank you. And check out all my nonsense at themovieguys.net.
We'll be putting that link up. Thanks, Paul. Both movies screen on Saturday and the following Tuesday at 7:30 p.m. Somewhere in Queens will be shown on June 17th and 20th, while Book Club, The Next Chapter, will be shown on June 24th and 27th. Tickets are $7 for adults, $6.50 for members, and $5 for students, and are available at the door only. The cinema series is sponsored by Lakeshore Savings. And that's it for this midsummer edition of Notes from the Aisle Seat. My thanks to Mr. Dan Ehas, Mr. Adam Cooley, and Mr. Paul Preston, the movie guy, for being my guests on this episode. Notes from the Aisle Seat is a production of the 1891 Fredonia Opera House in Fredonia, New York. For more information on any of the Opera House's events, call the box office at 716-679-1891, visit the website at www.fredopera.org, or email at operahouse@fredopera.org. Notes from the Aisle Seat is now available wherever you get your podcasts, and also on the Opera House YouTube channel. If you like this podcast, please consider following us by clicking the follow button on our home website at aisleseat.podbean.com and spreading the word through your social media feeds. If you have an arts event you'd like featured on the podcast, why don't you drop us a line at operahouse@fredopera.org, and we'll see about featuring your event. Please try to give us a month's advance notice, if possible, to facilitate timely scheduling. If you have any suggestions, comments, or criticisms of the podcast, just drop us a line at operahouse@fredopera.org. We'll be glad to receive your feedback. Our next and final episode of Season 2 will be available on June 28th, 2023. I'm Tom Laughlin, and until then, be safe out there, and be kind to one another.